Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Laffer Associates conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note, this call may be recorded. I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Arthur Laffer.
Hey, everybody. How are you today? I hope all of you got the email last night on the economic issues with regard to the coronavirus and what our proposal has been to the White House and others, and I hope it makes some sense to you. Today, I want to make sure you get some of the medical background as well, and I wanted to provide you with a conversation with two people I rely on very heavily for medical advice vis-a-vis things like the coronavirus. The two people are Dr. F.J. Campbell. I got to know him very, very well when he was CMO, Chief Medical Officer at Centennial. This was at the time I was chairman of the board, and he guided me through all of this stuff really, really well, an amazing person. Today, he was both CMO and Chief Quality Officer at Ardent Health Services. The other person who's on the call today is Dr. Michael Stabile, and Mike is not only my best friend, which he is, and I confer with him on all sorts of stuff, but he was also head of anesthesiology at Centennial Hospital. By the way, Centennial, for those of you who don't know, is the flagship for HCA. He was also head of the MEC, which is the credential committee of the board of directors of Centennial Hospital when I was chairman there as well, and he is an interim CMO for a while at Centennial. And he's now head of Centennial's COVID-19 efforts. These two people are very knowledgeable. They don't do talks like this usually, but I'm very grateful that they were willing to have their arms twisted to be able to do it today. I'm introducing Dr. Campbell and Dr. Stabile. Gentlemen, you're off.
Well, I think, first of all, I want to thank all of you for giving us an opportunity to connect with you. What I find so challenging right now is the uncertainty that we're dealing with across many sectors, and it's not just uncertainty for the healthcare industry, but the ripple effect that it's created across so many other industries. And what I want people to really appreciate out of this is, like any pandemic, there's a beginning, there's a middle, and then there is an end. And in that beginning phase, we're really trying to just have a realization of what we're up against. We're at the end of the beginning, and we're now at the beginning of the middle, and that really is the execution phase. And things that you're going to want to have an appreciation for to reduce the uncertainty that you're experiencing, not just within healthcare, but as a result, the ripple effect that's creating to so many other industries, is that testing is going to give us a much better understanding of what we're up against. What's the number of people in our populace that actually has this? The data that's coming out of China would give you an impression that maybe this is an experience that goes on for about 4 months. If the quality of that data is there, then great. I think that you can find that in the same way that there was a significant increase in the number of patients identified around mid-February, that is when their testing efforts really began to ramp up. And if you were going to look at what's now happening across Western Europe, they're facing that extreme increase in number of confirmed cases simply because their testing efforts have basically panned out. I think Western Europe is going to give us a very reliable view into the number of cases that we're having. I don't necessarily believe that their response will be as good as ours, because we have better critical care, and Mike will talk about that. But now we are in the middle of this phase within the United States. You are going to see the numbers go up, but that's going to be secondary to the amount of testing that's now going to happen within the United States. That will be a factor. It's going to help drive what we need to do with social distancing. You know, that's a great therapy for our communities to, number one, improve the public health circumstances we face, but number two, get greater control over what they can do within their own communities. Aggressive social distancing is a strong positive. It should be viewed as the steps we need to take that will bring back normalcy in the end. The other thing that you're going to want to be looking for is, okay, fine. have hospitals really ramped up their efforts to have a coordinated response so that we can handle what will be increase in hospital volumes, mainly increases in critical care. When you see that those efforts tangibly have taken hold, you'll know that we've firmly gotten to the execution phase, and that's what's going to expedite getting to resolution. And the point for resolution that I really want you to wrap your mind around in is this. What we want to look for in Western Europe and then later in the United States is simply this, that the number of patients who have recovered exceeds the number of patients who are newly diagnosed. Whether this is going to happen in July or August is an estimate. I would much prefer to give you, here are the mile markers along the way that will give you more verifiable, more certain data to bring you out of this period of uncertainty. Michael?
Thanks. I think I want to echo some of FJ's thoughts in terms of the time sequence for this. And we don't want to commit necessarily to a number, but my impression from the prior, the experiences of, that we have from China, South Korea, and Singapore, this looks like a two-month cycle. The two things I think that are critical when you're looking at, and first of all, using the phraseology pandemic, we didn't really serve ourselves well, because pandemic almost exclusively in our mind refers to the 1918 flu, which was catastrophic. The definition of a pandemic is three infections at different geographical locations that are ongoing. So we have pandemics from a strict definition, but the media using the phraseology pandemic has not helped here. What I want you to look at are things like the really critical thing for you and for society is things called the case fatality rate. And the case fatality rate for an infection is the number of deaths over the number of cases. And that's really critical. Now, if you look at something like rabies, it has a case fatality rate that approaches 100%. If you look at a case fatality rate for a traditional flu season, it's probably somewhere about 0.2%. Yeah. That's 2 in 1,000. Now, there's interesting things about that in the sense that a typical flu season, the most vulnerable are the very, very young children and the very elderly. If you really do a deep dive in these numbers, the WHO told you the case fatality rate for this was 3%, and I would say that is not really an appropriate number. If you look at case fatality rates in China outside of Wuhan province, it's 0.16%, not that different from the 0.2 or 0.12 that you would see during a normal flu season. The other intriguing thing about this is that this infection has somehow or other spared children, it spared millennials, it spared essentially people under 50. The people that have the higher case fatality rates will be people over 60, 70, seems to be more males, and they seem to have some comorbidities, things such as COPD, hypertension, and diabetes. Now, I think we may need to make a commentary on what you're seeing in terms of Western Europe that's ahead of you, okay? Because they're probably 2 weeks ahead of us.
I would say they're no more than three weeks ahead of the experience that'll take place within the United States. And I think one thing that we have to appreciate here, as Mike brought clear, is who's really at risk. And what's driving their mortality, I don't think is necessarily because the strain is more virulent in one part of the world versus another. I mean, there is some evidence for that. But under the circumstances, it's the quality of critical care. When I read about that Italy has more doctors per 100,000 people and more hospital beds per 100,000 people. My point here would be, well, what doctors are you talking about and what kind of hospital beds are you talking about? The thing that caused the problem in Italy is their absence of critical care. When you look at Italy, they had about 12.5 ICU beds per 100,000. In the United States, we have over 34. That's the number that's the money number.
And the reason that's critical, because, and frankly, in 100 years, the only question historians are going to mention are how many people died. And the end therapy for this revolves around you having respiratory failure and dying. And that is totally dependent on your ICU respiratory therapies and technologies.
No doubt about it.
That's the final tool to actually solve the end problem.
Right now there isn't a great therapy. There isn't a pharmaceutical intervention here. So it's not like, hey, steroids are the answer or antibiotics are the answer. In fact, in some cases, steroids make it worse. This isn't a function of, hey, this is a bacteria that we have to go after. It's a virus. There are not a lot of secondary infections. This comes down to how well you can get oxygen into the person and how well you can basically ventilate them if they can't breathe on their own. This is all about successful critical care when we're in the hospital.
Right.
Now, outside of the hospital, you know, this is about our communities in the most cheerful and adversity manner, embracing social distancing. You know, this is the way to basically take the oxygen out of the fire. If we really all embrace social distancing, probably for about 8 weeks, this will simply run its course out for the vast community, and at that point, we'll be much more ready to move into the resolution phase of recovering those patients who are in our hospitals. So timelines are what you're looking for, and I appreciate that. We've come to an end of the beginning. We're at the beginning of the middle. Execution means aggressive testing so we know how big a problem we've got, driving social distancing, equipping our hospitals with, and this is a true concern, the personal protective equipment that they need. I mean, it is a real issue that we don't have certain things like gowns, masks to meet the supply that we need. This is where private industry can really have a huge impact on the public by ramping up our efforts meaningfully to supply the hospitals with what they need to respond to this effectively.
So what's going to happen, I think, in the next week or two, so some of the hysteria from the Northern Italian Lombardy experience really hasn't served the American public or markets. But I would say,
agreed,
when you are looking, what you're going to see in the next week, remember, Italy has 12 beds per 100,000 population. Well, in the next week, you're going to see Great Britain, who we think in terms we have a lot of commonality with. But unfortunately, Great Britain only has 6.6 beds per 100,000 population. So I expect things are going to be reasonably chaotic in Great Britain. What I would tell you if you were looking at how this is being managed and what the ghost of, you know, Christmas or flu future looks like, it's probably going to look a little more like Germany, which has like 29 to 30 beds per 100,000, which mimics
critical care beds
per 100,000, which mimics North America.
So, Dr. Laffer, I think that I don't want to risk us retreading the same comments that we've made. Do you or your colleagues have any questions for...
Let me ask. Leo, are you there, Leo?
I am here.
Great. Could you open it up for questions for everyone?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Mike, FJ. Thank you very much. We'll open it up for questions.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 now on your touchtone phone. That is star 1 now on your touchtone phone. One moment while we queue. And it appears we have no questions at this time, but once again, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. We'll take a question from Catherine Wood of ARC. Your line is open.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi. Hi, Art and doctors. Thank you very much for doing this call. Yesterday, or I believe on Friday, there was a study published. I know that Stanford and Columbia professors were involved, which pointed out that a malaria medicine, is it chloroquinine, has been effective in China and South Korea. Actually, Elon Musk tweeted it. That's how I found out about it. So just wondered if you've heard about that. The CDC was involved in evaluating it as well. So I just wanted to know what you know about it.
Yes, I was made aware of that article the other day. This is Mike Stabile. This is a very intriguing commentary on an information age and the sort of the upside of an information age. The first bronchoalveolar lavages, samples taken from a lung were isolated in Wuhan. Approximately 10 days later, we knew the genotype sequence. 10 days later. As of the first month after the outbreak, there were more peer-reviewed published articles about the Wuhan outbreak than there were for the whole SARS outbreak at 18 months. So there's an actual some upside to, one of the upsides to basically in an information age being able to pass around therapies and information like that. But it's an anti-malarial. They're using it in lower doses. And like I said, I'm sure that people will be testing it. But at the end of the day, most of this comes down to supportive respiratory care. Basically getting people over a critical thing called ARDS, an adult respiratory distress syndrome, which can, and actually there's the data suggests that the actual timeline of it is less than a usual traditional ARDS, which can happen under a lot of different sequences.
Yeah,
and Mike, one thing.
There are about 10 trials right now for chloroquine. What's nice about it is that's been used for, good Lord, over 50 years. So we have it's a medication that we know a lot about, but you're going to also be reading about a number of the antivirals that are being trialed right now. And that's just it. When I'm speaking to common things that we would use in these kind of circumstances, like steroids or antibiotics, those are the therapies that are, number one, broadly available, and number two, broadly understood. So the challenge that we have right now, and we're kind of in a race to see what's going to be effective, is how effective are some of the current antivirals going to be? So number one, we have to appreciate, are they efficacious in this circumstance? And then we would have to actually determine what can we have in terms of supply if we have to get to scale. And that's why I think therapy...
FJ, is that the same thing for protein inhibitors?
You know, all of what we're going to have to be doing has to be thought of at bringing to scale to a large population. So I think that any of the therapies that are out there, it's not necessarily, the first question is, are they effective? The next question is, what's the ability to ramp them to scale? So we could find in clinical trials that they're proving to be effective. My question is going to be, that's great for the small population that you worked with. How are you going to bring that to 250,000 people?
Gotcha. Next question. Kathy, is that okay?
Yeah. No, that's great. But apparently, I know I'm not pronouncing it.
Chloroquinine.
Chloroquinine is, it's been around since 1945. It's readily available. It's cheap because it's generic. And so it just struck me that we hadn't heard anything about it, even though the CDC is involved in, I guess, the study of it.
Well, let me bring up a point here. One of the points is that the overwhelming majority of people that are infected with a coronavirus, a lot of them are going to have no symptoms. A large percentage are going to have mild symptoms. So if you're introducing therapies, a lot of times it's a risk-reward. Are the side effects of the therapies going to outweigh the actual benefits of the therapies? Like I said, at the end of the day, the commonality that leads to death is respiratory failure, and we have a lot of sophisticated technology in North America to deal with respiratory failure
right.
In tertiary and quaternary hospitals.
Great.
The availability of quality critical care within the United States greatly outstrips the quality of critical care in almost all Western countries. Not all of them. They either match what we have or they're behind us. This is the place to be critically ill.
Thanks. Next question.
We'll move next to Richard Leist of MetLife. Your line is open.
Hello. Thank you for the call.
Hello, Richard. How are you, sir?
Terrific. I have folks in 15 countries around the world, so I've been trying to keep on top of this. And I had two questions, please. The first is, I've read some reports that the degree of contagion of this virus is unique, that it's easier to pass from person to person. It lives on surfaces longer than normal viruses. I was hoping you could just comment on that. And the second question is, when I look at the rate of contagion, like how quickly the cases are spreading, Japan is unusually subdued. It doesn't seem like it's taking off the way it's taking off in Europe and other places around the world. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
No. All right, okay. So let me start off. There was a little bit to unpack in that. Let's talk about how long this virus is perceived to survive on a, let's say, an inanimate object. Anywhere from 2 to 9 days is what you can read about. And I think one of the challenges there is when people were initially looking at this, they were thinking, well, flu typically stays alive on a surface for about 48 hours. So I don't know that we have a consensus opinion on that. But let's just face it, even if it is, you know, 2-3+ days, that's a long time. Now, the challenge of this coronavirus, and I'm sure you're all aware, is in terms of being contagious, the biggest difference here is that a person can effectively have no fever, no cough, no shortness of breath for even up to 10 to 14 days, and in that period of time, they are shedding virus, if you will. That's a big difference between this COVID-19 coronavirus and common flu. That's a challenge. Now, relative to why this may be less of a factor, it's more, as you're saying, subdued within Japan, here is one thing. There are, at this point, as we know of, at least two variants of the coronavirus. And from an epidemiologic standpoint, I'd be curious to see what's going on with China. There's the L strain and the S strain. By convenience, I'll tell you that the L strain is, you know, larger in numbers, about 70%, and more lethal. I would want to know if there was a greater concentration of the S strain within Japan, but I have not been able to find that myself. Michael?
I think, is it Richard? I'm sorry, is it Richard?
Yep.
Yes, it is.
Okay, hey, Richard. I think there's two things. The amount of transmissibility is called, we call it an R-naught, okay? And so what that means is that if you have an infection, the number of people that are susceptible to that infection that you can infect, okay? If you look at a typical flu season, the R-naught is about 1.4. The initial R-naught for this was 2.6, okay? However, that data and the construction of that equation comes out of China, okay? So my contention is that the actual R-naught, the higher the R-naught is, basically is the more highly transmissible it is. And that's dependent on the infectious agents itself, how much social contact people have, and how long the infection lasts. But my contention is that was an inflated number. The reason I think that's an inflated, and that's not unusual with any new infection or whatever, because basically what happens with that is your number of cases are basically there's an overestimation of the number of cases. Because, example, in Wuhan, they weren't testing for, there was a whole subgroup of people, once again, that don't have symptoms with this. So I would say that the R-naught for this, there's probably 3 to 4 or 5-fold people that don't have any symptoms with this. And you're basically, that would factor into your denominator. So I think the R-naught is a lot lower. I'll give you a little, it was, I think, in the Jerusalem Post yesterday, there was an article about the Princess Diamond. And Princess Diamond was one of the cruise ships where everyone was literally confined on the cruise ship for a month, okay? I think it was close to a month.
Yes.
The actual percentage of people that actually converted for coronavirus as they were leaving the ship was 20%. If the R naught for this were 2.6, that number wouldn't make any sense at all. It would be 30, 40,
yes.
50, 60%. So you almost have a little bit of a lab experiment there.
And one thing to appreciate here is this. We have a much better appreciation for flu because think about it. Any of you, I mean, you can go into a grocery store, and if they have a MinuteClinic, their entire business operation is predicated being able to test for flu and give you Tamiflu if necessary. So our capacity to appreciate the disease penetrance during a big flu season is Mars and Venus in comparison to what we have right now, which is why, number one, the mortality rates, confirmed cases to people who actually pass away from flu, we have the capacity to change the numerator and denominator because of better information dramatically with flu. If we had mass testing to have a full appreciation of those who could have COVID-19, but they're mildly symptomatic, then all of a sudden you're going to be in a situation where the denominator changes and the mortality rates would be decidedly
lower,
closer in alignment by moving down to what we were seeing, not necessarily at the level of flu, I think it would be more dramatic than that, but if we had a much, much better understanding of the total population infected, it would be a larger number, and therefore what would happen with the actual mortality rates would be more favorable.
And I'm going to make a comment on the other thing I thought was artificially inflated was the case fatality rate, which was they said it was 3.5% or something?
Something like that.
Okay, so let me give you a context on that. That data, first of all, comes out of China again. Well, example, if you were the only people that are going to actually show up are people or older people and people in extremists. So I think, and then those people are tested and they test positive for coronavirus. So then you get a number that's artificially inflated. If you went through the people that actually had it in a broad population in Wuhan and look at the case fatality rate is literally the number of deaths over the number of actual people that have the diagnosis on a coronavirus test. If he had actually done that, the case fatality rate, once again, would be dramatically lower. It's not 3.5%.
And Mike, isn't it true that a lot of them smoked, which makes it far more susceptible for fatalities?
Well, whether it was smoking or not, the bottom line is
the numbers aren't wrong.
The in terms of the conditions that people had that put them at risk, no question about it. Things like emphysema, or what we in the health profession call COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or if they have diabetes, or if they have significant heart disease or hypertension, all of those things factor in to depleting the capacity for a person to endure this condition and therefore, you know, fall prey to, you know, lung injury. But put on the top of that list, you know, people who already have injured lungs from emphysema, COPD, are certainly going to be less equipped to respond and mobilize against this kind of virus. And that's not an uncommon condition for people who are over 60 and, yes, have a history of smoking.
Richard, is that okay?
Yeah, it's very helpful. Just one follow-up, please. Are there any countries that you're particularly worried about?
I'm worried about the UK.
You don't
say anything. I wouldn't come. I think.
And these comments are coming from my good colleague, Dr. Stevens.
Yeah, I would say. Countries, I guess you could look at countries that managed it well and countries that didn't manage it well. Okay, South Korea managed it well because they got a lot of information out early. They had a lot of actual tests. The tests weren't necessarily needed for directing therapies. The tests were useful to pick out pockets of patients or people to isolate. So that's how they cleverly used the tests. They also have a reasonably sophisticated healthcare system. You talked about Japan, Richard. If you go to South Korea, Richard, two-thirds of the cases come out of a religious cult called the Shintoji cult. The Shintoji cult...
Shintoji.
I'm sorry, FJ. The Shintoji basically congregate in a closed space, 5,000 to 10,000, and chant for 3 hours.
And refuse to wear masks.
And refuse to wear masks. So if you would have looked just in terms of doing the social distancing we had done other places, I would assume that their numbers would have approximated Japan.
Yeah, what happened in South Korea was a bimodal distribution. You had one population that was the antithesis of social distancing.
Yeah.
I mean, they wrote the book on how not to do social distancing versus a population that ferociously and quickly embraced social distancing to the credit of the leaders within South Korea, which is why you have that bimodal distribution, but it averages out to what it averages out to. I've been very pleased with what's happened in the United States, really to the credit of mayors and governors on one level and the federal government on another. There was a lot of voluntary acceptance of, hey, we're going to move towards social distancing. I do believe the United States, as a result, is to our benefit.
Yeah. FJ, can I interject here for a second? What about Britain and what about Italy?
Italy.
Can I do the Italy one?
You go to do the Italy one.
Okay. the challenge with Italy in part is, I mean, it was a wrenching experience, and you can read about this from, their own internal media sources. Social distancing in Italy is something that they embraced too late. Now, what's impressive about Italy is that they finally realized quarantining all of North Italy was a dramatic step that people weren't expecting in Western Europe, and then days later doing the whole country. I think that what they did was incredibly honorable, but too late.
And how about
Britain? Michael?
I think Britain potentially has a problem. I think when you only have 6.6 beds per 100,000, ICU beds per 100,000, I think this is going to be problematic. The problem with this thing, and it's, we've been talking about it for about a month, but now it's literally getting some sort of traction, is a thing called a flattening of a curve. And a flattening of a curve means that when you have a spike in this, that you don't overrun your capabilities of taking care of your sicker patients. There's every indication we're going to be able to manage that very well. Your Seattle experience suggests that already, okay? You have a sophisticated healthcare system. You're going to have enough ICU beds. I just don't see that happening in the UK. Now, part of, and I don't want to get the science, and FJ can, I don't want to get the science wrong, but part of the initial strategy in the UK was actually not to quarantine and to basically get a certain amount of herd immunity in the population and expect the spring and summer to smooth that out. There's actually, whether it's a strategy or not is immaterial, because they didn't have any other end game. They were not going to have enough capacity to take care of these patients if they overwhelm their hospitals and ICUs. I think they basically now have gone to a draconian quarantine, it looks like, in the UK.
But if I can just summarize, you're worried a little bit about Italy and about Britain for Richard's comment about other countries.
Right, but I don't think that's going to – my comment is that I don't think our experience here is going to mirror that.
Right.
Yeah, he's not asking that question. He's asking what it will be. He has a lot of relations abroad. Let me get the next question, Leo, if I can. Richard, that's okay with you?
Yeah, thank you very much. Very thorough.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Ralph Lehman of Blue Ocean. Your line is open.
Hey, Ralph. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Art. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. I have a really quick just clarification question. I got on a couple minutes late, and I heard the doctors mention that the timeline could be about 2 months, give or take. And I'm just curious when those 2 months would have started in the United States in your minds.
That's I'm sorry, what's your first name?
Ralph.
Ralph.
Hey, Ralph. Michael Stabile here. I base that on the South Korean, Singapore, and Chinese experience, okay? I think in the U.S., I think we're about 2 to 3 weeks into it.
I would say that we're 2 to 3 weeks into it. Now here's where Mike and I have a possibly different approach to this. I think what he is looking at is, if we can believe the information coming out of China, then that two-month estimate could actually have some legs. It's a function of, can we believe that there was a level of transparency to this process of information sharing coming from China? As far as of uncertainty and risk, you have to decide whether you have that information. My perspective, what I'm looking at more is most certainly what's going on in Western Europe and tracking their timelines, because I think there will be more transparency of data, but I'm much more focused on the key thing that I'm looking for in the United States is I want to see that increase in number of confirmed cases relative to testing. And I think that we will have a better understanding of that population that we have in the United States. I think that we will have an idea of how big a problem we have within 2 to 3 weeks. I'm very confident of that. Now, from that point on, then I want to see the next marker that I'm looking for is that cases recovered, patients recovered, is exceeding new cases diagnosed. So I'm looking for 2 points. The rapid rise in confirmed cases in the United States, and I think we're going to see that in 3 weeks. And then from that point on, the time that you're looking for, or the data that you're looking for, is that recovered population is well exceeding newly diagnosed. And if that's going to be the length of time it takes, but because critical care in the United States is so good, we could potentially be bullish on that. But those are the two timelines, those are the two processes that you're looking for.
Ralph, is that
not on time?
Ralph,
my assumptions around this were based on first cases found in Wuhan, essentially December 2nd. At the January 1st, you have a cluster of patients. January 15th in Wuhan, you have a spike and you start having deaths. And as of probably, Arthur can comment on this, as of last week, it seems to be that China or the Wuhan province is open for business. That's my understanding. So if you really look at when the first cases really show up, January 1st, and you look at maybe a week ago, you're looking at, 8 to 9 weeks.
Ralph, that okay?
That's perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question.
We'll move next to Austin George. Your line is open.
George Austin, by the way. Hey, George, how are you?
Hello, Arthur. Thank you, Arthur. Thank you, doctors. And thank you for the extensive discussion of critical care beds in various countries. Could you expand that to future staffing over the next few weeks in hospitals and supplies? I just spoke with the retired CEO of a hospital that I was involved with. He said there's a certain fear factor developing in hospitals regarding non-exposure, to having to take care of their children at home, schools out. And just comment on the supply front, the CEO of Cleveland Clinic was on Maria this morning saying that there are plenty of supplies, at least at Cleveland Clinic. I wouldn't say plenty, but he said adequate. So 2 points, staffing and supplies, please.
I'll start off with supplies. Adequate is about as good an answer or about the most optimistic answer that anyone who's being intellectually honest will be able to communicate right now. There is a clear need for what's called N95 masks. There's a need for impermeable gowns. And it really comes down to how you want to establish protections in the hospital. Do you want to have everyone in the hospital wearing personal protective equipment? Well, that's not a situation that we ever really supply for. That's not a situation that any hospital realistically supplies for. Now, do that at the level of how long you would have to do that. So there's going to be some uncertainty there, secondary to the fact that we have now created, we have now come to a circumstance where trying to have what's called personal protective equipment, you know, broadly distributed across all personnel in the hospital is a scenario that no hospital, no healthcare system prepares for a long period of time. So we won't be able to provide that level of PPE until we have a significant ramp up in production of those things. The problem is those production lines come from places like China. So there are other countries, Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia. So until we actually have more supply, that's going to create more uncertainty, and that's going to create more uncertainty in our healthcare workforce. And that is why people are saying, hey, are we seeing an increase in the number of call-outs? The answer to that is no. Now, is that going to happen over time? We'll see. But if there is anything that is going to bring stability to this situation, it's to ensure that what we have in terms of N95 masks and impermeable gowns is being supplied at a meaningful level. And this is a time for when the federal government has to make it happen, period.
George, I have just one comment. You have two parallel things going on. You have a COVID-19 crisis, but parallel to that, you have, so we're not the NFL, we're not the NBA. We're basically a healthcare. We can't close down. We have to continue to provide essential health care. If you need heart disease, if you need your chemotherapy, those processes and that delivery of those services has to go on. If we panic and limit all that, we'll end up doing more harm than we would with a COVID-19 infection. Now, one of the less, so if you go back, and this is an interesting thing for hospital systems and for how we monitor ourselves. If you go back to the SARS epidemic in Canada, in Ontario, and they doing a debrief a year or two after that, one of the things they said was the amount of quarantining of their actual healthcare personnel interfered with the delivery of services, and that was a strategic miscue.
But what you're saying already, FJ and Mike, you're saying that there are no signs right yet of people doing sick outs and not showing up.
No, that's a commentary on, frankly, a very dedicated American.
That's wonderful. No, that's just wonderful news. I was not aware of that.
Now,
George, is that okay with you?
Well said. That's very helpful, Arthur.
Thank you very much. Next question, Leo.
We'll move next to Chris Walters of Blue Cora. Your line is open.
Hello, Chris. How are you, sir?
Hey, Art. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
Good. So two things to ask about the workplace. All right, so many companies are having everyone work from home, and those who are fortunate enough where that's possible, it's a great thing to do. It sounds like you're suggesting that the timeline where that should continue is likely to be 8 to 9 weeks. I just want to confirm that. And is that right?
Well, relative to what we're doing with social distancing in the workplace, one of the things that's happening right now is we've got schools and universities that are basically beginning to shut down their operations. And now that's one thing that's going to be, when I say shut down their operations, pardon me, they're moving that to an online format. Okay, you know, that's one thing that's adding to those numbers. I think that what we're going to be needing to do with social distancing, we're going to have a clear idea of how long that's going to have to take place once we have a clear idea of what's the true number of people in our population that has that, and that we've done a better job at that point of seeing new cases decline because of the success of social distancing. So are we going to have social distancing measures that go on for 2 months? And that would seem long, but here's the thing. I would rather you focus on the actual things that you can look for and process. Do I think we have to have aggressive social distancing for the next 4 weeks? Definitely. Do I hope that in that period of time that we're going to see, hey, we've had significant testing, now we have an idea what's, you know, the penetrance in our population, and we're seeing new cases begin to decline? Guys, that's what you're looking for. There's no sense trying to commit to come down here and say the exact date. I know you want that.
Okay, Chris, you had one other part of the question?
Yeah, I did, but honestly, I wasn't looking for an exact date. I was looking for a range in terms of planning purposes. So we have the benefit of 90% of our staff can work from home. But we want to set expectations on this could be, you know, a month or it could be 3 months. And so that was one question. And the second one is for the people that do have to work, and this could be everything from people in retail environments or grocery stores or the critical jobs that actually have to come into the office. What are some of the things that you suggest to make sure that we protect those workers in the best way we can?
So, again, I want to reiterate, I think that we'll have a clear understanding of whether it's, you know, 1 month, 2 months, or 3 months. I think we have a good 1 month of really aggressively embracing social distancing. I think that we'll be in a much better position in about 4 weeks to see how much longer that has to last. So we'll be in a better position in about 4 weeks to make that longer-term prognostication. And I think that that is reasonable we'll be able to do. For those in the interim, there's something to say for the fact that a consideration coming out from the White House right now is you really want to avoid social gatherings of more than 10 people. And that's something that I think that is not just for social gatherings. I mean, that could be in a situation where in a work environment, we are still trying to maintain social distancing of a good 6 feet. So, you know, to that end, I think that is something that is going to be practically impacting us for the next 4 weeks. So if you have to be in a workplace, yeah, you still want to be in a situation where you can ideally maintain a good 6 foot perimeter around people when at all possible, and really trying to be in a situation where, you know, when you are in a workspace with other people, if it's reasonably confined, you want to keep it to probably no more than 10 for any kind of extended period of time where you have exposure.
Thank you, FJ.
Thank you.
Is that okay, Chris?
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question?
We'll move next to Greg Williamson of Pluribus Labs. Your line is open.
Hello, thank Greg. How are you, sir?
I am actually self-quarantined, Arthur, so I'll let you know after I get a call.
Well, all of San Francisco is, isn't it?
Well, we're all sheltered at home, and that was one of the questions I had, Doctor. What is the difference in your mind between social distancing and sheltering at home, and are we going to see more sheltering at home across the U.S.? Second question is, you said testing is important, but hospitals don't have the capability or the supplies right now for mass testing. When do you think we'll get to having those supplies and capabilities for mass testing?
Mike will handle the social distancing, and I'll handle the testing, because unfortunately I'm going to have to exit from the call, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to communicate with you. I would tell you that I think that the testing capabilities in the United States is going to be significantly ramping. It's already ramping in the communities that I'm in, where we're beginning to see drive-through testing opportunities in multiple of my markets. So I think that that's something that's going to really take hold in the next 2 weeks, that we're going to start having a much more meaningful access to testing. I really applaud the federal government and the White House's efforts to engage private industry to expand the aperture of testing opportunities. What we need to appreciate here is right now, perfect is the enemy of good. We are bringing tests to the market that we would ideally have a longer period of time to understand their efficacy and what exactly they mean in terms of a true positive and a true negative. But, okay, it is what it is. So I think that the testing efforts are going to become much more meaningful in the United States within about 2 weeks, and that will continue for 2 weeks beyond that. That's what I believe. That's what I'm counting on. Michael?
I almost think the whole testing thing is a distraction, Greg. And let me tell you why. A, there's no specific therapy for you being infected with the coronavirus. I'm only gonna actually, and even if you have the coronavirus and you went to supposedly some clinical setting, if you were not short of breath, right? You wouldn't pull any trigger to admit you to the hospital, and that's why I say you, the end game of having ICU capacity is so critical. Okay, and the majority of people have little or no symptoms. When you're looking at a flu and you test positive for flu, I get data, and then that brings down things like my case fatality rate, or you can see, and you get epidemiological data, which is critical. But the coronavirus testing in this short period, aside from telling us where the people are that have it or giving us some ideas about case fatality rates, I mean, for the next 2 or 3 weeks, we need to concentrate on having enough protective gowns, having enough ICU beds, and having enough ICU staff. The commentary about, there are two different things you were talking about. You were talking about social distancing, right? That means limiting public events, eliminating MBA, washing your hands, staying far apart. Cocooning is a very different phenomena. Cocooning means if you are over 65 or 70 and you have some comorbidities or you're in a nursing home, you basically need to eliminate any visitation or contact with outside people, because there you are actually most prone to the, if you do get it, then your case fatality rate in that demographic is very high. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. The president has suggested that further strong measures could be forthcoming, though, and I'm wondering if that would include sheltering at home versus just social distancing requirements.
I think I'm not going to comment, or I don't know about public, you know, his potential public policy, but I think, example for a hospital, we at one point at my, quaternary medical center, we had, I think, 84 entrances. We now have 10 entrances, okay? We limit the number of people that can come visit someone. So, and once again, you're mirroring populations that are susceptible. They need their contacts with outside society need to be really, really limited for this period of time.
We got it. Leo, any more questions?
Hey,
Greg, that was okay,
now,
wasn't it? It answered?
Yes, Mr. or Dr. Laffer, we do have several others in queue.
Good, let's go.
We'll go next with Jessica Blakely of Laffer Associates. Your line is open.
Hi there.
Hi
there.
Jessica, how are you?
I'm doing well. I just have a quick question. I'm wondering if you have seen an increase in utilization in telehealth, and if so, in what capacity?
You will, and I think one of the things is like I said, essential health care is going to go on, and I don't want family members to visit the hospital. So I'm going to basically probably very soon be wheeling a monitor into your room. They're going to be at a distant site. It could be on the hospital grounds, but they're not going to have contact with their family members. And you basically, for example, if you at some point arrive in an ICU with respiratory failure and a coronavirus diagnosis, well, no one's going to be able to visit you. So families are still going to want to have updates, and that's going to be done remotely. But, you know, we've been using a lot of telehealth now for years, pretty successfully, actually, you know.
Jessica, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jessica.
Jessica, they also may be using it, example, to screen people, because you're going to have – you know, you're going to have people show up, and you're not. So, go back to the SARS 2002 experience. When you looked at the actual cases in Ontario, 75% of those cases somehow or other drifted through the Scarborough Hospital system. So there were people showing up for example testing around it that may have not actually needed a – they may not have had respiratory failure at that point. And I think that's the other thing we want to do. We don't want people showing up at a hospital. That's not going to help us now. If you're sick and you're short of breath, we want you at the hospital immediately. But the majority of people, we don't want people showing up asking, can we test for this if they have mild flu symptoms or a typical flu symptom. That's not going to help the healthcare system or that individual hospital.
Right.
Leo, let's go to the next one, Leo.
We'll move next to Tom Berger of Gridiron Capital. Your line is open.
Hey, Art.
Hello, Tom. How are you, sir?
Doing well. So, hey, a couple of questions, and you know, I know I told you this a week ago, but you know, I don't fear the virus, but I'm terrified of the reaction that everybody's having to the virus. I think the question is this twofold. One, in warmer temperature climates, are we seeing any less spread or efficacy of the virus? And two, looking out, I mean, there's been other viruses in the past. I mean, this seems to me that it just sets up for every time there's a new virus that comes about, everybody's going to lock down and we're going to see a huge economic impact. And you know, nobody's been able to, you know, impact us in our history through war on our own lands, but, you know, this is shutting down the U.S. economy. It's causing companies to just go black. We'll see how many of them actually survive, but huge impact. So twofold on the warm climate efficacy, and then on the other one, how do you see this playing out in the future as we have other viruses that evolve?
Can I paraphrase your last one? It's almost like an economic autoimmune response.
Yes,
that's great. Well, the first thing, your first commentary on just when you have respiratory borne viruses, when it's colder, your nasal sneezing and stuff, there's more precipitation and it travels farther, and that's an issue. The other issue with colder weather and flu seasons is we literally congregate more indoors and have closer social contact. So the social distancing is important. Now, as a brief commentary going forward, what we're doing, I'm not talking about the extreme measures of this, but the things we're doing in terms of hand washing and social distancing and not shaking hands and is actually a pretty good thing going forward for a flu season in the future. Now, if you're looking at...
Hello?
You hung up, guys.
Hello? Oh, okay. Oh, you hear me now?
Yeah, I can, yes, but it's really static.
Okay. Is it better now?
No.
Okay.
Just go ahead. Go ahead, Mike.
Tom, are you there?
Yeah, we're there. Go. Yep.
Okay. So I think there's three things. I think you hit it on the head. This is a flu season that has somehow transcended into a some sort of financial societal catastrophe, and a lot of it just didn't have to be. Now there's a few interesting things when you're looking at big flu pandemics. Okay, when you're looking at the big flu pandemics, you're looking at 1918, you're looking at 1957, you're looking at 1968, the Hong Kong flu. If you actually looked at the economic impact of those, I really don't comment on, because the 1918 flu was an anomaly, but those two would be a more modulated response. The issue around this flu, this is a zoonotic flu, and this is the third, this is the third zoonotic infection that has gone from bats to a second animal to humans and translated into a respiratory. So I totally agree. I think there's been a bit of an overreaction. This is not now. It hasn't shown itself to be a spectacularly clever virus in terms of mutating and morphing. So it's like I said, as FJ has articulated, it should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. But I'm shaking my head about why it's totally unhinging financial markets and actual you know, day-to-day life. So.
Yeah, and if you haven't,
if I'm looking at it as a clinician,
just came out and said that he is strongly considering requiring everyone in the state of New York to shelter in place.
Yeah. Well, I can't make, like I said, I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not really, what I can say is this will have, you know, like every other, it'll have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the other thing that'll come out of this, from when you're looking at any societal impact, right, from any infection, at the end of the day, it comes down to lethality. In terms of things that have happened in the past, it might be more infectious than SARS and the Middle East MERS, right? But in terms of lethality, it's dramatically less than SARS. You're going to see its lethality rate is probably, it might be tenfold less. So I'm a little, like I said, I'm pretty optimistic about aspects of this.
Okay, thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Next question, Leo. Thanks, Tom.
We have a question from Carlo Corin, surgical scanner. Your line is open.
Hello, Carlo. I think you know who is the speaker on the other side of the line.
I sure do. Gentlemen, thank you for doing this. One of the questions I have, there's a lot of misinformation out there, you know, whether it's from Fauci, that this is 10 times stronger or more potent than other diseases that are out there. Influenza, et cetera. Where do we get, you know, correct information that we can share with our teams, our employees, et cetera, so that, or even our families, because even my children have different perspectives on things, and I just would love to be able to reach out to an authoritative source. I'll wait for the answer.
Well, FJ has left the room, so the authoritative source is gone. I'm the only guy left behind, Carlo. But I would think when you're looking, like I think I referenced earlier, when you're looking at any new infection or an epidemic, once again, just means that an infection is ongoing. Okay, but when you're looking at an epidemic or you're looking at an infection, the R-naught, the transmissibility, and or how many people are going to affect, and the case fatality rates are usually artificially skewed higher at the beginning so you get more numbers. So there's Dr. Fauci's probably correct if he's looking at strict World Health Organization numbers. Whenever you're doing a public health process, yeah, really have nothing to lose by painting the worst scenario, and then if it goes well, it looks better. But if you underplay the significance of it, there's political consequences to that. So, but when you peel out a lot of the data, I don't know if this is going to look dramatically different than a really bad flu season. Now, there's one thing that most of the members. Your audience doesn't see that I've seen, you know, for 30 years. In a typical flu season, a small percentage of patients show up at a tertiary and quaternary hospital with end-stage respiratory disease and die, or have to have very long recoveries and everything. That happens every year. The public is just somewhat, you know, they don't really, it's not in their consciousness. One of the commentaries the other day is, whether we're prepared for this, yes and no. You can make a commentary, are we prepared for a flu season that kills 30 to 50,000 of us every year? Is that preparedness? Is that knocking it out of the park? So, I don't know if this is dramatically different than things that have gone on in the past. It looks like the case fatality rate, and it's specifically for people under 50, kids here, a pediatric population is totally spared. There's a lot of upside to this as a, you know, as a pandemic. You know what I mean?
Thanks very much, Carlo. That answer your question?
Mr. Corin's line is no longer in Q&A.
Oh, okay. Any more? Questions?
There are no further questions.
There are no further questions. Thank you very much, everybody. Appreciate you being on the line. Talk to you all later. Bye.